C1PR Chapter 1 Prayer The Structure of the Christian Science Textbook Our Way of Life Number 1A
Now we have come together here for a work which may take us quite some time, and therefore I would like to devote this afternoon to set the tone for these meetings. One of the first tone which I would like would prevail every one of our meeting is science. I have sent you a little booklet called Why Study Christian Science as a Science, and I tried to publish it in time so that you can read it through before you were coming to this meeting. In this little book, I haven't said anything new. I have just summarized the main points of what we are considering and the main points of what constitutes the fundamentals, or I would even say only the rudimentals of pure science. There is nothing new in it, and yet I felt, for some reasons, which perhaps at a later moment I can tell you, that it is right to take stock, so to say, of what we want to achieve with our study and with our life. It is, so to say, a small credo, or credo, as you may say, of pure science. And as I have given some of the main lines of what science means and what means to approach the infinite on a scientific way, or through a scientific way, I can just take a few points out of that booklet and dwell on it a little bit more. I have said nothing new in that booklet. And I think, in one way, it is just paraphrasing what Mr. Dorley has said and what some of his students have said. But I feel at this juncture what we really need, and I think it is because I feel that need, is to get the profundity of what this wonderful term science means, and the profundity of a scientific approach to the infinite. So, it is rather the depth of what we have always known, perhaps visionary, perhaps intellectually, perhaps just in a mental way, to try and find the depths of it. Looking back over all the centuries and thousands of years, we can see that the subject God was always foremost in people's minds. It was first the big question, is there a God? And the Old Testament more or less can summarize by saying, it shows that there is a God, and only one God, and that one God is Spirit. And there was always a sense and a longing in the human mind to be one with that God. And Jesus came and showed that man can be one with God, that man must be one with God, and that man can be one with God, and he exemplified it. And there was afterwards a big period where men and women of the finest type tried to emulate what Jesus had exemplified, and tried to emulate it in many ways, in art, in literature, in music, in architecture, in all the ways they were able to do it. To live a life which approaches the nearest good, which approached the nearest to what Jesus exemplified. But then came that period with lots of birth throes where men went deeper. And when men and women asked themselves the how and the why of all these things, where we were asking, what is this God Spirit? Where we were asking ourselves, how can I be one with God? Where we began to ask, how can I live that life which is nearest a God-like life? It was the breaking of the period of knowing, of science. And it's no wonder that this period of science tried to have its impress also on the search of God. On the search, what is God? How can I be one with God? And how can I live the life which is the nearest good? And so, quite a new epoch, a new era has started, which has that overall tone of science. And what we learn by it is this, that when a new period is breaking in, we should not try to go back to the manna of yesterday. We should not go back and try to give us an answer to these big questions in the way of yesterday, through religious belief, through creeds, through certain rituals, and so on. This is always an enormous question when a new period is breaking in on humanity. Can we leave the old? Are we big enough to leave the old landmarks? And are we big enough to be the pioneers that follow up the new light? The light here is science. The light here is not only science that we begin to see that God is a science, that we can more or less substitute the term God for the term the science of ideas. It is not only that period which more or less can dispense with the term God and replace it to that much more important, profound, and deep meaning sense of the principle of being. But there is also the second side to every question of science, namely that there is a scientific approach to the subject of the science. So we have to be quite clear that two big new views try to be established in this age and in those of this age who are willing to listen, namely that God is not a mystical being, that God is not the unknown, that God is not just some supreme undefined being, but that God takes on that new name of science of ideas. Science which includes in itself all those categories of science. And second, that we are willing in this age to approach that new subject, not with the old ways, not through the old channels, but through the channels of science, through scientific channels. This is quite a mouthful if one has been educated in a theological, religious way. So let's face that. This is one point which we have always to be very clear about, especially as we go through the first three big chapters of the textbook, that we keep in mind that our approach must be scientific and must not be dominated by the old sense of prayer, by the old sense of atonement and Eucharist, and by the old sense of relationships or marriage. But that right from the beginning, we must take that wonderful, clear-cut, profound, deep meaning sense that we have to deal with facts of divinity, scientific facts of divinity. Another point. Is science something spectacular? No. Science is simple. That's the beauty of it. That's the bigness of it. Science, as you know, is defined, among others, as knowledge reduced to law and embodied in system. What does that mean? Well, I don't have to say much about it. I tried to explain that in my little booklet. And I showed there how the meaning of science is this, that it can take infinity, that it can take any wide, vast, infinite subject, and can make out from this rather wide and infinite subject something very simple. How Mrs. Eddy has used this wonderful method of science to reduce those infinite questions about God and man and creation, how she has reduced those infinite queries about God, man and creation down to 7 and 4, to the 7 synonymous terms operating in 4 ways as the Word, Christ, Christianity and science, to 7 and 4. That together is only 11 facts. Deep facts. Profound facts. Not superficial facts. Not 7 words. Not 7 terms. 7 profound pillars of consciousness. But they are simple beyond means. And that's what I feel in my bones today. What is needed is to get more and more that profundity of the 7 and 4. If we have those few facts clear, clearer and clearer, we have not only 11 facts, we have infinity. That's the meaning of science. That's the meaning of science, that we can have so few facts, but if they are the root notions of a science, and if they contain the root laws of this science, we have the all of that science. I can imagine nothing more beautiful, nothing more wonderful, nothing more consoling and comforting, and nothing more happy and joyous than to take from one shoulder the task to know the infinite through infinite truth, and to throw that off and have the same infinitude much clearer, much profounder, much more certain, much more definite through the system of 7 and 4. If we think of the love and endeavor and the work that in the last 1,000 years the best people have put into trying to live up to Jesus' standard, up to a God-like standard, trying to do this on what ground? They had no basis. They had no basis. And that was their burden. That was the burden of life they had to carry. That they tried hard and tried hard and tried hard. They were sincere, but they had no foundation. And because they had no foundation, which was broad enough, wide enough, and certain enough, they must have been despairing of their work. Today, we live in that wonderful age of science. And our heart just should overflow with that gratitude to have science. No matter at this moment what this will mean to us, just the mere fact that there is a key to the infinite. Not yet wondering what will open up to us the moment we turn that key in the lock. But just that gratitude should fill our thought that we have the key, that we are so fortunate to have the key. The key of the 7 and 4 11th fact. Remember in Judges, for instance, how Samson, that type of the strength of manhood, was tempted through the 11 shekels which Delilah would get if she could rob Samson of his strength. And how he was tempted to leave those 7 locks in 4 ways. And in the 4th time, he failed to keep them. And Delilah got her 11 shekels of silver. Was that 11 of manhood which tells us, if we can fathom those 7 and those 4, and if we can love them and adore them and worship them and value them and just find that the end and all, the beginning and all of everything, then Delilah can't do a thing with us, and we will have that strength of manhood. You know that right after that story, Judges tells again of the 11, how the mother of Micah has lost her 1,100 shekels, you say shekels, of silver, and how her son, Micah, has stolen it. And how that false motherhood asked of Micah to give it back. And the moment Micah was not strong enough and gave it back, he got into trouble. He couldn't fulfill his wonderful mission. 1,100 shekels of silver. showing always how we should always keep in mind the seven and the four in its simplicity, but in its profundity. I was very often wondering what Jesus really meant when he said, "Thou hast been faithful over a few things, I will make thee ruler over many." I was wondering that long and long, and I gave myself this answer and that answer, and it satisfied me a little bit, and satisfied me and another answer also a little bit. But finally you come down and say, what are those few things which give you power over all? The seven and the four. There is nothing more outside the seven and the four. We can think things out as long as we want. We can search as long as we want. There is not one divine question which has not its place in the profound but simple system of the seven and the four. So what do we want more than to keep those 1,100 shekels of silver and not give them away anymore? But that needs motherhood. False motherhood wants to rob it. Let's have that motherhood which loves it and loves it and begins to value it and begins to value it above everything. And then it stays with us. What do we gain by it? Again, if we have the system, we have the all. And really only as we have the system, have we access to the all of infinitude. See, it's like with a tree that has thousands, millions of leaves. If we have the root, we have the tree. If we have the root, we have the millions of leaves on the tree. If we don't have the root, the leaves fade away and are dead. So, let's get the root. Let's go down to the root. The more secure, the more firmly grounded the tree is in the root, the more harmonious and self-supporting is the tree. The sounder the root is, the less we have to care about the whole tree. It will blossom and flourish and grow and become big and carry fruit more than we can take. But the root must be sound. The foundation must be sound. All that comes out of it is so natural, so spontaneous, that it doesn't give us any further trouble. You think, well, that's very natural. Well, we have heard that so often. Yes, that's just the thing. That we have heard it so often, and yet one is in the practitioner's office, one sees and realizes that one has said these things so often, and yet they are not understood. You see, time and time again, when we are face to face with any problem, we think of the problem, we think of the detail. We look at one leaf, how it is not growing well, and we are mesmerized by one leaf, not the root of the tree. But if one nourishes the root properly, and if the root of the tree has all what it needs to grow, the tree is all right, is healthy and free. And so we are always mesmerized the moment the problem comes up to look away from science and to look at the problem. Not to go back first to the root, to the system, and let everything grow out of the system, and let the solution let grow out of the system. A few weeks ago I read a joke in the Reader's Digest. I didn't laugh about it, I didn't find it's a very good joke. And yet it was so true. And the joke was more or less like this. Little Johnny was in the classroom and the teacher asked him, "Johnny, what are two kippers and two kippers?" And Johnny didn't know. And so the teacher said to Johnny, "All right, I come back in a quarter of an hour and then you tell me the solution." And when the teacher came back in a quarter of an hour, little Johnny didn't know what two kippers and two kippers are. So the teacher said to little Johnny, "But little Johnny, you must know it. Now, what are two bananas and two bananas?" He said, "Oh yes, that's easy. That's four bananas. That's bananas." Well, happily you laugh a little bit. That's the joke. But that little Johnny sits in us very deeply. Very deeply. That little Johnny says, "I'm face to face with a problem. I don't know the solution." And yet, we have studied for years and years the root. We have studied that 2 and 2 are 4. And if we would have studied that 2 and 2 are 4 as a science, then 2 and 2 are 4. And that 2 and 2 are 4, if we calculate with bananas, or with kippers, or with apples, or with horses, or with houses, or with people, 2 and 2 are 4. And all what the science of arithmetic is concerned with is 2 and 2 equal 4. And it isn't concerned a little bit about banana and about kippers. But we think God is. We think we are face to face with a problem, something outside of God, something which God does not know, and then we are mesmerized by those bananas and kippers.